Greetings and good evening, everybody, from Nashville, Tennessee. Today is March 15th, 2017. Welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Fraley. This is the very first edition of the podcast. What we hope to do with this podcast is to share with friends the interesting people and stories from my career as a lawyer, my previous career in parks and recreation, and from my various interests in conservation, family history, gardening, and maybe even music. Hopefully not politics. At the beginning, there will be no regular schedule for these podcasts. However, we hope to start with doing a couple presentations each month. We hope you will bear with us as we learn the technicalities of editing audio files and posting podcasts to the World Wide Web. We will be setting up a Facebook page for the podcast. We will be posting information about upcoming presentations at that Facebook site. If you like what you hear, tell your friends about it. Tonight our guest is Bob Richards. And Bob is a fellow that I've known since probably 78 or 79, 1978, 1979, when I first came to work at the Tennessee Department of Conservation. Bob is a graduate of the University of Tennessee Forestry School.
Correct.
Back in, what, 75?
Yes, all 1975.
Right. And you began to work in the Department of Conservation even before then.
Correct. I started out in June of 1974 as a seasonal naturalist at Fall Creek Falls State Park. Back then, it was under the Governor Dunn administration, and back then there were three seasonal naturalists and three seasonal recreators. And Fall Creek Falls was brand new. It opened up in July of 1972. And so everybody was coming to the park to stay at the inn, swim in the pool, stay at the campgrounds, and just see all the beautiful waterfalls that the park has to offer, not to mention the new lake that they had built. So people were fishing and boating on the lake. So it was a fun time. I had some good experiences there. You mentioned that I got my degree in forestry from UT Knoxville. That was also an interesting experience. I grew up on a cul-de-sac in Nashville. My folks moved to Nashville in 1952 when I was 15 months old, and it was one of the newer subdivisions at that time. There were 10 houses on each side of the street, and so we lived at house number 4 going up a little hill. And so as I got older, all I had to do was walk out the front door, walk down, take a right, walk down the street, 5 houses, and I was in the woods. So I got to play in the woods growing up, and that's how I developed my love for trees, for nature.
So that wooded area in that neighborhood today is developed.
Oh, yeah. They came through with the bulldozers in the early 60s, and I guess they put the sewers, extending them up Richland Creek, and so they took the bulldozer and just went to the end of the cul-de-sac and cranked them up and took off and extended near Top Drive by another mile.
So you went to UT Forestry School. The other person I know that is a graduate of that program was Jerry Dillehay.
Correct.
And Jerry worked at Conservation for many years in the Recreation Services Division. Mainly handling the grants to local governments for local parks. But he studied with Dr. Shell there at UTK in forestry. Were you in that forest recreation program as well?
Dr. Shell was also my advisor. He became my advisor in my junior year. Okay. He was one crazy dude. And at that time, forestry school included both timber management, right, wildlife management, and then they had a couple forest recreation courses. So it was a relatively easy course to take, so everybody took it. to get the good grade. But it was, you know, once again, I mentioned I started out as a naturalist there at Fall Creek Falls, and as I found out a couple years later, a lady my age named Ann Tuck Jr., actually her mother, Ann Tuck, was a commissioner of the Department of Conservation under Winfield Dunn. And Ann was working in the Department of Personnel, and she was going through these stacks of applications looking for seasonal positions, and happened to see my application and says, "Robert Richards. I know Robert Richards. He would be great for this position." So as I found out, having that connection, and I knew Ann and the Tuck family through church. We went to West End United Methodist there in Nashville. And so the point I want to make is that you never know who your connections are, and so it's always good, especially nowadays, to network with other people.
Well, you ended up graduating and then coming on full-time with the department. Of course, I know that the department still, I'm sure today, is going to hire people that they know before they hire people that they don't know. And you being a person that they knew was a person that they wanted to bring on a full-time basis.
That's correct. Right. I started working with the Trails program in June of 1975, and I was there at Fall Creek. Actually, I was hired in another seasonal position, and then there was a federal funded jobs program came available in 75, and so it was the Comprehensive Education Training
Act. CEDA program.
Good old CEDA program, which funded a lot of positions across the state. But
I was Parks and Recreation Director for Gatlinburg, the city of Gatlinburg, as a CEDA project.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was my first job in Tennessee.
Well,
isn't that interesting?
Oh, I didn't realize we had that connection. But that was in the early days of the Rivers, Trails, and Natural Areas program. The Tennessee Scenic Rivers Act was passed in 1968, after the National Scenic Rivers Act was passed, and then the National Trails Act was passed in 68, and the Tennessee Trails Act was passed in 1971, and then the Natural Areas Act was passed in 74. The Tennessee Natural Areas Act was passed in 74. And so you had scenic rivers, scenic trails, and natural areas. And so that was in a small section called the Natural Resources Unit.
Right. That was under Walter Criley.
That was in Walter Criley's planning and development section.
Right.
And so through the CEDA program, we were able to fund 13 people and 3 regional trails crew. The guys that worked over in West Tennessee worked on the Hatchie Scenic River, keeping the river channel open, and then would do trail work in the state parks. I was assigned to a crew, started out at Fall Creek Falls, was there for a year, built the Cane Creek Lower Loop and the Cane Creek Upper Loop trail, and then got transferred to Savage Gulf in July of 1976. And then the East Tennessee crew was working on the Cumberland Trail at that time, and the gentleman that was the Cumberland Trail administrator, first one was Dave Shoup. He was based out of Crossville. The second one was Mike Dahl, and he was based out of Knoxville.
I remember those fellas. Let me ask you this. You know, our listeners, many of them will be Nashville people listening, are frequent visitors to Radnor Lake.
Correct.
And you go to Radnor Lake, and the visitor center is named after Walter Criley.
That's correct.
I certainly knew him well. You knew him well. But the average visitor to Radnor Lake has no idea in the world who that is. What impression do you carry with you today about Mr. Criley?
Mr. Criley had a planning background, and he was exceedingly conscientious and wanted the facilities that were being built in Tennessee State Parks at that time to fit in with the landscape. Backing up to 1965, the Land and Water Conservation Fund was passed at the federal level. It was authorized at $900 million a year, and the source of the funding was from the revenue off the offshore gas and oil leases. And so it was not tax money. It was this other source of revenue. And so the whole intent of Congress was to take those funds, because they were depleting a natural resource, and use that money to build, you know, parks, natural areas, and outdoor-based facilities and state and national parks. The program was never funded at the $900 million level, but all 50 states did receive significant funding for the projects. I know for a fact in Fall Creek Falls, all the developments there at the park, lake, golf course, campgrounds, swimming pool, village green area, boat dock, the inns and the cabins, they were funded. Half of the funding came from LWCF, and that was $4 million. And then the other half of the funding came from the Economic Development Agency, the EDA. Right. And the whole focus of creating the resources at Fall Creek Falls was to create jobs in a rural community that really did not have any jobs.
Exactly. There's an old study still on somebody's shelf somewhere that talks about the economic aspects of Fall Creek Falls. And, of course, they're going through a proposed changes now to try to bring that in the concession operations into private hands.
Correct. They're talking about outsourcing it and letting a private operator run the inn. Back in the 70s, I don't remember the exact number, but they had approximately 300 positions. That's both permanent, full-time, year-round. And then they probably had 150, 160 permanent, full-time, and then another 140, 150 seasonal. And so, you know, it was putting a lot of college kids to work and local residents who were out of, you know, high school or in college. And so, once again, it was quite the boost to the local economy.
So other than the, we'll get back and talk a lot more about the trails program, but you've had worn several different hats in the agency over the years that didn't have to do with trails. Tell us more.
Well, trails was my first love and the best job I've ever had. I was with the trails program from June of 75 through February of 1987, when the Department of Conservation, quote, abolished the trails program. What they did is they took the funding they were putting into trails, which was $250,000 a year in 1985, 86, 87, and reallocated those fundings. The field people went to work with the regional maintenance crews, and then the three coordinators, of which I was one, were morphed, so to speak, into state park planners. Well, I got pissed off and left, so I went into business for myself. That lasted 16 months. I'm not a very good business person. I make a hell of an employee. But I came back to work with the state in the exact same position I had left from, because they froze the position and it was still vacant.
Okay.
The folks that were still there, Terry Bonham, I think, was running the show around that time. A new gentleman came on board. His name was Ken Travis, and he was in charge of what was then known as the planning section. And so we had Terry as the chief, and we had four regional planners, Jackson, Nashville. I was, well, they had four areas of the state. So we had one in west, one in middle, one. I was area three, which is basically the Kermit Plateau region, Kentucky to Chattanooga. And then area four was over in Knoxville. So we had four state park planners, and within 18 months' time, we developed 51 strategic management plans for each of the state parks. And that was a huge effort. They were approved, I think it was July or August of 89, and it was the first time that that had ever been done as a system-wide effort. And then once we had the management plans in place, we continued as planners, but where our focus changed from just purely planning to working with the park staff, the state park area managers on capital maintenance projects over $50,000 or new projects going on in a park in our region.
Okay, very good. Now, did you at one point work for Joyce Hoyle in Recreation Services Division?
Yes. As I mentioned, I love greenways and trails. So Joyce was the director of Recreation Services Division. So in March of 1993, she enticed me away from state parks, telling me she was going to, the Rec Services was going to be working on greenways and trails. About that time, there was federal funding that came available for the Recreational Trails Program. Tennessee, the first year the program was in existence, got, I think it was $177,000. We quickly put the program together in a 90-day period, had a grant cycle for 30 days, and awarded $725,000 grants.
To local government agencies?
Yes, they were to local governments.
To build trails and greenways in our cities.
Correct. Okay. And one of the projects that I remember the most was up in Kingsport. Kingsport had come up with the Kingsport Green Belt, and so they got a $25,000 grant to build, I think it was another quarter to a third of a mile of paved greenway trail along Reedy Creek, which is a tributary to the Holston River.
That program's still in existence.
Yes, it is. And Tennessee has received probably over $20 million in recreational trails program funding. The unique part of Rec Trails program is it's actually funding from the federal gasoline tax that is the gasoline used by off-highway vehicles. So the off-highway vehicle folks are paying for the Rec Trails program for not only motorized trails, non-motorized trails, but diverse use trails, which can either be motorized or non-motorized. Diverse use in Tennessee is considered more than one type of use on a trail. So if you have a paved greenway, all the miles here in Nashville, and you got bicycle and pedestrian use on it, that is a diverse use trail.
I got you. Nashville has developed a pretty broad range of greenways in our city.
Yeah, Nashville has the largest number of paved greenway trails of any major metro in the state of Tennessee that I'm aware of. They are over 80 miles of trails. The Nashville Greenways Program started back in 1995. Shane Dennison was working for the Metro Historical Commission, and she was actually wearing two hats, doing kind of double duty, both in her historical position, preservation position, and with the greenways. And then, you know, they got the position created in Metro Parks, and so she shifted over to Metro Parks and has been director of the program ever since that time.
You know, we have now more sophisticated local park and recreation agencies throughout Tennessee than we've ever had. I can remember starting in 79 going out and visiting with local governments around the state, and we had a few very good recreation departments, park and recreation agencies, but we had a lot of places that had no professional services at all than local government.
Correct.
So the grants programs that the state has and the federal government has, are they increasing the capacity of local governments to deliver these services?
The direct answer is yes. And the way that's worked is back in 1991, the state legislature passed the Local Park and Recreation Fund Act, which is financed through the real estate recordation tax. And it's like a penny and a half per $100 of real estate value. So if you sold a house for $100,000, the local park and rec fund might get $20. I'm not sure about the math on that. It may be a little more, yeah. But
I actually was involved in the writing of that legislation with Kathleen Williams Meridian.
Okay.
So back in those days. So yes, and that's also used for historic preservation activities as
yes.
well.
Yes. Right. There are four pots of money. State lands acquisition gets funding, local park and recreation gets funding. There is wetlands money that goes to Tennessee Wildlife Resources Agency. And then the Department of Agriculture gets a small portion to do wetland conservation and sustainable ag practices. So it was a very targeted piece of legislation, but it also has provided significant funds for local parks and recreation, which is targeted specifically at cities and counties.
You know, Bob, you know this as well as I do. The way that legislation was thought about, the philosophy of it was, as Tennessee grows and is developed,
correct,
the need for local park and recreation and other sorts of recreation services grows also.
Yeah, the need increases as more people move into different subdivisions or houses across the state.
With the incredible growth that we've had here in Middle Tennessee, I think it was a good idea to have that started back then.
Oh, it's incredibly beneficial, and even if a small community does not have a full blown park and recreation department, they can still be providing recreation facilities such as swimming pool, ball fields, greenways and trails, and just even open space, you know, buying land to preserve it for the future,
right.
You know, so they can protect it now and develop it later. I know, continuing on with my career saga, I worked with Rec Services and Joyce Hoyle through 1996. In 1996, I left the state for the second time, went to work for the Cumberland Valley Girl Scout Council, which is here in Middle Tennessee, and I was their director of property and facilities. At that time, the Girl Scouts had 10 Girl Scout camps scattered throughout their 38-county region. And so I was managing those 10 camps plus the service center there at Battery Lane and Granny White Pike. And so I was supervising 12 full-time, part-time staff and the camps, which went from just a very small camp there near McMinnville, Tennessee, where they had a couple of picnic shelters and access to Hickory Creek with some canoes. And so you would go out there, you know, the older kids that were had a higher skill levels and their adult leaders who had been trained would go out and just pitch tents there to the jewel of the council was Camp Sycamore Hills, which is out north of Ashland City. Camp Sycamore Hills was a 700-acre dairy farm, which they bought in the late 50s, early 60s, and converted the barn into a commercial kitchen dining facility. And then they have the whole gamut of program activities. The camp actually owned 2 miles of Sycamore Creek, so they were able to canoe on their own piece of Sycamore Creek. They had a very extensive horse program. I think they had 25 horses that the troops could go out and ride. And then they had everything from platform tents to cabins. And they had one cabin on the north side of Sycamore Creek, which is called the Tree Houses, and it was an elevated second story bunkhouse. So, you know, you could be on your shelter when it's raining under the actual structures and do your cooking, have a campfire nearby. So it was a really nice facility. So I don't remember who designed it, but they did a really good job at that.
I want to jump in at this point. We're running out of time. This is I want to try to go, maybe we'll go over a little bit, but I want to have you talk a little bit about what's going on with the Cumberland Trail now, if there's what's going on with the Trail of Tears,
and sure.
What's going on with those programs?
Well, that takes us back to the original 71 Act. In the 71 Act, there were 7 designated state scenic trails and state recreation trails, which were to be constructed in state parks or state-owned areas, and then side and connecting trails. You mentioned the Cumberland Trail. It was one of the founding reasons for the Act. It was being promoted by the Tennessee Trails Association, and a number of the leaders of TTA were pushing.
And where does the Cumberland Trail start and end, or
sure,
it
starts
in planning anyway?
It started in down in Chattanooga at Signal Point Park, which is overlooking the Tennessee River Gorge. You look across over the river, and you can see Lookout Mountain. So it's just outside of downtown Chattanooga up in the town of Signal Mountain. And then it goes north along the edge of the Cumberland Plateau Escarpment and crosses through Cumberland County and continues up on which once you get north I-40, you're in the Cumberland Mountains. And then it goes to the tri-state corner for Kentucky, Virginia and Tennessee, which is up in Cumberland Gap National Historic Park.
All right. How much of that trail is actually constructed now?
The last figure I saw.
Percentage-wise?
It's about 192 miles, which is going to be about two-thirds of the total, which is 300 plus or minus. In 1993, Cumberland Trail Conference was created as an associate organization of the Tennessee Trails Association, and it has been one of the primary groups actually physically building the Cumberland Trail.
Yeah, I know our old buddy Bobby Fulcher is the park manager for the Cumberland Trail.
Bobby Fulcher is one of those institutions, been around probably close to 40 years now. And he has been managing the Cumberland Trail probably for the last 10 years.
Right.
He's got 4 or 5 rangers, but 4 or 5 rangers for a 300-mile trail really isn't very much staff.
Right.
But they're working in partnership with, you know, the Cumberland Trail State Park is the managing entity, but they're working with Cumberland Trails Conference, Friends of Cumberland Mountain State Park, Tennessee Trails Association, and they're actually having what they call spring breakaway right now, which is the alternative spring break program.
College kids coming in and building trails.
Yeah, they'll bring that. 10 or 12 college kids in a 15-passenger van, and then they'll stay for a week.
Some of this trail is on state-owned land. Some of it's on privately owned land that there's a license acquired to cross. Or was...
Back in the day, it was literally a handshake agreement.
Okay.
When Governor Don Sundquist was during his administration, Justin Wilson was deputy or the commissioner of TDEC at that time, and he allocated quite a significant amount of funding for the Cumberland Trail for land to be acquired. So I think they're at 93% to 94% purchase.
Actually owned.
Yeah, where the state actually owns that much of the actual route. And some of it's a 50-foot wide easement, provides right of public use and the right to build the trail across.
So that's an ongoing project that people should pay attention to. I noticed the other day that they're promoting the sale of a specialized license plate for the Cumberland Trail.
That's something that's new that's just happened, and people may not be aware you have to have 1,000 people commit to doing a special plate. So right now in that time period where they need 1,000 people to, you know, send in their $35.
Maybe we'll get some of our listeners to do that.
That would be great.
Talk about the Trail of Tears. Of course, historically, that's associated with the Cherokees being run out of Tennessee and North Carolina and made to go to Oklahoma to the reservations there.
Correct.
And it was obviously a terrible time for them. But there are various places in Tennessee are associated with that happening, that historic happening.
And Southeast Tennessee is actually the epicenter.
Starting at Red Clay?
Red Clay actually was the capital of the Cherokee Nation from 1832 to 1838 when they physically were removed. The Cherokee Nation extended from Virginia all the way south into North Carolina, Georgia, and Alabama, and then a significant part of East Tennessee, as well as a little bit of Kentucky in Virginia. And each, the government, you know, once the American government was created and founded, they would do treaties with Cherokees because, you know, of the Western expansion coming off the Atlantic seacoast. And so the Cherokee Nation would continue to get smaller and smaller and smaller. Well, Andrew Jackson got the legislation. It was called the Indian Removal Act. It was passed in 1830. And so it set forth that the five major tribes in the Southeast, the Seminoles, the Chickasaws, the Muscogee Creeks, the Cherokee, and there's one other, would leave eastern U.S. and have reservation areas in what's known as Indian Territory at that time, which is now the state of Oklahoma.
As far as a trail is concerned, how is that being implemented, if at all, here in Tennessee?
Well, the Trail of Tears is actually a National Historic Trail.
Okay.
And so that is under the umbrella of the National Scenic Trails Act. And so it's being, I think there's 7 National Scenic Trails and 12 National Historic Trails. So it's being managed through the
National Park Service. Okay.
Through the Long Distance Trails Office in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Okay.
But those folks have been in Tennessee on numerous occasions and work very closely with the Trail of Tears Association. which is comprised of groups in the 11 states that the Cherokees traveled through on the Trail of Tears. Started back in, 1834, when the Cherokee Nation got basically removed from Georgia, so they came north and into southeast Tennessee, and then they started actually physically rounding them up in 1837, 1838, and there were, my understanding, 16,000 Cherokee people at that time. And so they broke them down in detachments of about 1,000 people each, and some went by water, Tennessee River, up to the Ohio, down the Mississippi, and then back up the Arkansas River, and they disembarked at Fort Smith, Arkansas. But a number of them went overland. There were approximately 15 detachments that went overland, and I think 10 or 11 of them went what's known as the Northern Route, which started there in Charleston, Tennessee, which was known as Fort Cass at that time. And they came down, they went west to the forks of the Tennessee River, Hiawassee River confluence. It's called Bly's Ferry. Ferried across the river, and then came across the Kern Plateau through McMinnville, Woodbury, Murfreesboro up to Nashville, and then left Tennessee up at Port Royal.
I remember being at Port Royal recently and yes. seeing some signs up there, but I never did really understand how that could possibly be connected to the Trail of Tears, but now you've explained it to me.
All right. Yes, Port Royal actually has an original route segment of the where they walked for the Trail of Tears.
For our listeners, Port Royal is right up next to Clarksville, essentially.
It's right at the Montgomery, Robertson and Montgomery County line. It's on the Red River.
My wife's family, the Killebrew family, historically had a farm right across the river from Port Royal.
Wow.
Beth's great grandfather, maybe three greats, was Joseph Buckner Killebrew, who was the first commissioner of agriculture for the state of Tennessee back in the day.
My goodness.
And there, we were up there visiting that home place recently, and went through Port Royal as well. Beautiful, beautiful area still.
Yes, Robertson County is another booming area, but it's primarily up the 431 corridor to Springfield, and then over in the eastern part of Robertson County, where you got Rich Chop and Greenbrier, and so you're getting overflow from Davidson County into Robertson. Back to the Trail of Tears. In the late 70s, there was effort put forth by the National Park Service in that initial designation as National Historic Trail. So it was also a state scenic trail. And management plan was done. And then there was another very concerted effort. When was it? Back around 2005 to update that original plan, and they've added numerous other routes.
This is not an intent. There's no intention to actually have a foot trail that a person can walk.
They are actually looking for original route segments.
Okay, segments of. Okay.
Yes, right. And that okay. There's a piece of it up there in Port Royal. It's an old turnpike.
Okay. All right.
And so down in Giles County, you've got the Bell Route that went basically followed US 64. They have portions of that have been signed. The Binge Route started in Fort Payne, Alabama, and then came up diagonally. Those two routes actually intersected in Pulaski, Tennessee, and then Binge went on diagonally to the northwest, crossed the Tennessee River there at Johnsonville. and then headed on out through Paris, Henry County, and then once again went up into Kentucky.
We're going to have to wind this down here just in a second because our time is getting short. But I want to hear what you're doing now. What are the future plans for Bob?
I came back for the third time in July of 2005 as the Tennessee Greenways and Trails Coordinator. And I came back to Rec Services, which is kind of interesting, but it was good being a part of that division because of the Rec Trails program funding, plus local park and recreation funds can be used both for outdoor, indoor rec, and the legislation specifically mentions greenways and trails. So there's been some significant funding investment in greenways and trails infrastructure over the past 11 and a half years. I retired from as Greenways and Trails Coordinator on December 31st, purchased a house in Knoxville, so I'm living in Knoxville, but I am in the process of creating my own little consulting business. And very so good. I'm still doing trail stuff.
So you're consulting, hopefully, you think, with local governments or with who?
Yeah, it'll be local governments or state governments. I'm hoping to be able to do some work with Tennessee State Parks once again.
Okay. All right.
Working with them, and they get a Rec Trails grant, or doing some maintenance work, or doing assessments on the state park trails.
Now, I understand that you have been involved with this historic rugby association. Are you still involved with them?
My friend Nancy Dorman, who I worked with at Beeman Park on several projects, is connected with Historic Rugby, and she asked if I would serve on their board. So I came on board as a board member of Historic Rugby in June of 2016. It's a 2-year term. Okay. So, yes, I'm connected not only through the board meetings, but I'm involved. They've got a trail project now where they're working on a new trail map, doing some trail maintenance. I've led a couple workshops up there for the folks there in rugby and other interested people. And so
rugby is one of the most incredible places to visit in Tennessee.
It's very sweet, and it's interesting. You have the actual historic village, and they have 12 to 15 original structures from the 1880s when it was first created, and then you've got Rugby State Natuary on one side and the Big South Fork on the other side. So they are in a great place to go visit rugby. They actually do have lodging, the Harrow Road Cafe,
right.
And have a nice weekend.
Bob, what would you say are the things that concern you most about conservation and the environment in Tennessee today?
People need to understand that in order to have greenways and trails, and when I say greenways, I'm talking about the paved paths, those just don't happen. Funding has to be allocated for those projects to be created, and not only that, once a trail is built, people tend to forget about it. One of the things I'm finding, or I found back in the 70s, and finding even still here 40 years later, that trails don't get maintained, and if they don't get maintained, they kind of get eroded, or they're just not kept up. You've got to keep those paint blazes where marking the trail. You got to keep the signs up. You got to update those trail maps. One of the big new trends, although it's now 20 years old, is mountain biking. And so there are folks all across the state of Tennessee build new mountain bike trails. So it's, if you build them, you have to maintain them.
Those can be pretty tough on the environment.
Can't be if they're not laid out correctly. That's been one of the things I've strived to do my entire career, is build sustainable trails that are low maintenance. You know, you're always going to have trees falling or dead limbs breaking off and falling on the trail, but that's something relatively easy to remove. But you know, if a trail's not routed in the right place to begin with, and the water starts coursing down it, it'll end up being a gully versus a trail.
Exactly. Well, Bob, I'm going to wind this up, and I want to say a special thank you for coming in and experimenting with me with this this first of this of these podcasts.
That's my pleasure, Mark.
And thank you, and we'll see you next time.
All righty.